This is VOA's International Edition. Coming up, new scrutiny over Iran's past nuclear activity. U.S. stock prices jump, but more volatility expected. No end to the migrant problem in Europe.
The EU does not have a centralized government-like approach to migration. It's really about coordinating the needs and the priorities of many different member states.
One of country music's great duos on the road again. These stories are more just ahead. I'm Ray Kugel. The head of the United Nations Atomic Agency watchdog says Iran turned over substantive amounts of information on its past nuclear activity, but cautions it is too early to say whether any of the documents contain new information. Yokia Amano is chief of the International Atomic Energy Agency.
We are now studying the explanation in writing, which we received on the 15th of August. We cannot discuss the details of the explanation submitted by Iran. Next step will be for us to study, review, and ask questions by the 15th of September, and then Iran and IAEA will engage in the substantiation process. At this stage, it is premature to say if there is any new information or not. We are now analyzing it, and we need to see the whole picture to have assessment.
Sanctions relief for Iran hinges on what the IAEA has to say about Iran's past and present nuclear efforts. The separate international agreement reached last month between six world powers and Tehran seeks to ensure Iran cannot build a nuclear weapon. Shahram Akbarzadeh is an Iranian analyst with Australia's Deakin University. He told International Edition's Victor Beatty the documents turned over to the IAEA reflect Tehran's apparent willingness to cooperate in order to gain sanctions relief.
What this shows is that the Iranians are extremely serious about getting that deal signed up with the international community. It is not certain, to my mind, how significant the relevance of military aspect is. It may be just old material that has been recycled.
Iran insists its program is peaceful, but apparently has limited UN inspectors to its sites.
Well, Iran has been reluctant, of course, to allow international inspections on its sites because Iran would see this and has always insisted that any inspection would have to be part of a package, and the package would have to include the removal of sanctions. So Iran has resisted inspections while sanctions are on. But the situation is very different now with the prospect of removing sanctions and Iranians' willingness to allow unprecedented access to its sites, which includes, I might add, some military sites.
Iran's envoy to the IAEA, Reza Najafi, declined to explain whether IAEA inspectors would be allowed to inspect Iran's Parchin military site south of Tehran, where some accuse the Islamic Republic of having conducted nuclear bomb-related experiments. Do you think that will be possible?
I think the Iranian officials would not want to make any promises either way about access to specific sites until they have the deal signed up by the Congress and by the Iranian Majlis. Any information that the Iranian officials would divulge at various media interviews would potentially be used by critics of the deal in the internal domestic debate to undermine and discredit the deal. So that explains largely why officials refrained from talking about that.
You mentioned that Iran seems to be serious about holding up its end of the bargain. Does this have everything to do with lifting of sanctions?
It has everything to do with the lifting of sanctions. The Iranian economy had effectively come to a standstill under international sanctions, and the Iranian government, including the supreme leader, had realized that the survival of the regime very much depends on the lifting of sanctions. So this is really an existential matter for the Iranian government, and they're pushing full throttle in that direction.
Well, Shahram, speaking of sanctions, a large cheering crowd is reported to have greeted President Hassan Rouhani in the western city of Hamadan Tuesday, following reports that those sanctions could be lifted as early next year. How important will it be for the Iranian people that these sanctions are lifted?
Sanctions are a blunt force. They affected the Iranian economy, Iranian population, just as much they affected the regime. So for the population, this is a number one priority. In fact, President Rouhani came to office with the promise of removing the sanctions. So this is very important for the population, and it's very important for the popularity of President Rouhani, because he will have delivered on what he had promised.
Shahram Akbarzadeh says the absence of any opposition to the nuclear agreement by the Supreme Leader Ayatollah Ali Khamenei tells him the Iranian regime is prepared to rejoin the international community. Akbarzadeh says is an Iranian analyst at Australia's Deakin University, and he was speaking with International Edition's Victor Beatty. Staying on the Iran deal, we have International Edition's G. Abby Lee here with us. Hi, G. What are some Twitter handles people can follow on the agreement?
Hi, Ray. I mentioned this handle before when it was launched, but it's worth mentioning it again. It's the Iran deal at the Iran deal, and the White House manages a Twitter account. In the description, it asks people to tweet questions and promises to set the record straight on the nuclear agreement. The account retweets a lot of Washington officials' support for the agreement. For example, it shared a tweet by Connecticut Representative Elizabeth Estey, who tweeted a link to her statement supporting the Iran nuclear deal. Another account you might want to follow is the IAEA, the International Atomic Energy Agency. Its handle is at IAEA.org. Regarding the nuclear deal, the account sent out this tweet Tuesday. Hashtag IAEA Board of Governors authorizes verification and monitoring in hashtag Iran in light of Security Council resolution.
Gee, what about accounts that are against this deal?
Well, Ray, funny that you ask, because there is an account that directly criticizes the Iran deal account. Its handle is at the Iran Bomb, and the description argues the agreement paves the way for Iran to develop nuclear bombs. It goes on to say, "We will set the record straight and refute the lies spread by the White House propaganda account at the Iran deal."
Well, that's curious. So What does it tweet about?
It urges people to join rallies against the Iran deal and actively promotes anti-Tehran sentiments. For instance, it asks the LGBT community to oppose the deal because engaging in homosexual relationship is illegal in Iran. I can kind of see what they're trying to do there, but not sure if there is a strong correlation between the two issues at hand.
Well, how influential really is this kind of account?
Ray, it has about 1,200 followers, as opposed to 25,000 followers for the Iran deal account. Ray?
Thanks for the update, G. That was G. Abby Lee, and she's on Twitter at G. Abby Lee. If you want to spell it, that's JEEABBEYLEE. And you can also comment on our website at www.voanews.com. This is VOA.
The news never stops, so keep current on your mobile device with VOA News. Just go to m.voanews.com/English for instant, up-to-the-minute news and entertainment. Check m.voanews.com/English on your handheld device for news as it happens. Stay connected with a fast-changing world with m.voanews.com/English.
Jazz America.
This is Russ Davis, and on my program Jazz America, I carry on the tradition begun decades ago by the great Willis Conover by exploring the wonders of a century of jazz history. I'll cover it all from Dixieland to swing to bebop to modal, free jazz, fusion, world jazz, contemporary, and beyond. Plus, you'll hear the words of the artists themselves as they tell their incredible stories. Join me for Jazz America, Saturdays and Sundays at 13 hours Universal Time, online at voanews.com and the Voice of America.
You're listening to VOA's International Edition. A big rebound on Wall Street. U.S. stocks roared ahead to their biggest daily percentage gains in almost 4 years Wednesday. The benchmark Dow Jones Industrials jumped 619 points, almost 4%, to finish at 16,285, following 6 days of big losses. Global stocks have been in a free fall for the past 2 weeks, in part over concerns about the state of China's slowing economy. The volatility caught the attention of VOA business reporter Alexis Christophorus in New York.
Volatility continues to be the word of the day on Wall Street. Traders remain cautious after a wild couple of days for global stock markets. U.S. stocks rallied strongly Wednesday morning following a volatile day in China. Some of those gains faded by midday. Tech companies led the gains higher for U.S. stocks, with Apple, Google, and Intel rising at least 2.5%. Banks also did well, with J.P. Morgan Chase and Citigroup increasing more than 2%. And Cameron International Corp. soared 40%. After agreeing to be bought by the oil company Schlumberger in a $14.8 billion deal. A money manager at Stifel Nicolaus said this type of short-term stock rally should not be much of a surprise given recent market weakness. He said nonetheless, investors are resetting their global growth expectations. New York Fed Bank President William Dudley said the upheaval in global markets has reduced the case for raising rates in September. Traders are now pricing in a 1-in-4 chance the central bank will act at its next meeting, down from almost even odds before China's surprise currency devaluation earlier this month.
Christophorus also says volatility is having a significant impact on the price of oil.
New data has oil traders forgetting about China, at least for the moment, and focusing once again on oversupply worries. Oil prices fell after weekly U.S. inventory data showed a surprise drop in gasoline demand and record high stockpiles of crude oil and petroleum products. Analysts have warned that gas demand is likely to wane at the end of the busy summer driving season, which could weigh on oil prices along with seasonal refinery maintenance. Gasoline futures recently traded down 4.5%. Oil prices have plunged in recent weeks on concerns the global glut of crude that halved oil prices in 2014 has yet to shrink. WTI crude oil settling at $38.60 a barrel, down 71 cents, or nearly 2%.
That's business reporter Alexis Christophorus in New York. Leaders from the Balkan states will be holding a summit today in Vienna on European integration. But the immigration crisis is expected to be high on the agenda. Tens of thousands of migrants have passed from Greece into the Balkans just over the past few days towards Western Europe. Countries on the front line of the crisis are demanding help from European partners. Angelo Chrysagulis is a fellow with the Europe program at Chatham House in London. He talked with International Edition's Jeffrey Young about why the European Union is having such trouble coming up with a unified policy for dealing with a massive migration wave.
The EU does not have a centralized government-like approach to migration. It's really about coordinating the needs and the priorities of many different member states. And as the membership of the EU has increased, and as the EU today includes countries with different geographical positions, some of which are close to areas of crisis, but others are further away from areas of crisis, and also countries with different economic development, meaning that different countries of the EU are attractive to various degrees to migratory flows, it means that different EU member states face different pressures from this migration problem. So the challenge for the EU is to come to bring all those different member states together around the table and come up with a common solution that will have to be agreed upon by all those member states.
Now, pushing against that resolution, obviously, we have a problem in a number of the European countries with nationalist elements, people within the countries that say No, lock the door, bolt it shut, put a guard in front of it. No, we don't want these people. Send them someplace else. And please explain for people how these nationalist forces, these internal forces, are causing a problem in reaching a resolution by the EU on this migration crisis.
Yeah, that's a critical dimension. Unfortunately, it's very difficult to think about it, because we're talking about human beings here, but the attitude in various member states really is not in my backyard. And this has been quite evident in the effort by the European Commission some months ago to institute a voluntary relocation scheme for a number of refugees within European countries. You see some European countries, such as Greece or Italy, facing immense first wave pressures. These are the countries where migrants land at first, and it creates enormous pressures on those countries. And we're talking about Greece and Italy. These are also countries in the Eurozone South, which means that there are countries that institute austerity, and there are these are countries that already see the rise of nationalist parties that are also fed by the economic crisis, and the migration further strengthens that. Then you see more affluent countries, such as Germany and the Netherlands. These are the countries where migrants eventually want to go to, or the UK. And there you have radical right parties that have always been anti-migration.
Washington-based Angelos Chrysagoulos is a fellow with the Europe program at Chatham House in London. He was speaking with International Edition's Jeffrey Young. An internal power struggle continues to plague Afghanistan's Taliban insurgency. Daniel Markey is an adjunct senior fellow for South Asia with the Council on Foreign Relations. He spoke with International Edition Susan Yaki about the division within the Taliban.
It is clear that not all of the Taliban leadership have accepted Mullah Omar's successor, Mullah Mansour. But precisely what part of that leadership is unwilling to accept him, and the consequences of that fracturing, whether it's likely to be a long-term split or the kind of short-term disagreements that we've seen in other parts of the Pakistani Taliban, for instance, when they've lost their leader, is at the moment unclear.
Mullah Abdul Manan, a brother of the late leader Mullah Omar, spoke with VOA, and he said that the leadership crisis is the biggest issue facing the Taliban, and that the rivals should avoid confrontation until a decision by religious scholars. What is your reaction to that?
Well, it certainly is a big deal. I mean, one thing that we should all keep in mind is that apparently Mullah Omar died as long as 2 years ago. So one thing that's quite interesting is how this leadership succession issue has been kept under wraps for possibly as long as 2 years, maybe even longer. And that suggests that the number of people who are really in the know in that tight inner circle of Taliban has been kept very, very small. Now that he's clearly dead, that Mullah Omar is clearly dead, the number of Taliban who will think that they have a say in who should be his successor grows significantly, and probably exposes the kinds of frictions that reportedly had existed, for instance, between field commanders and those leaders who have been based inside of Pakistan or elsewhere. And those kinds of splits have been somewhat apparent over the years, but now they may be bursting out into the open.
Well, it's been so long. Does there need to be a new leader officially announced in public, or can they continue just as they're doing now?
No, there absolutely needs to be a new leader in order for the Taliban to be the kind of unified insurgent movement that it has been, to continue to wage a reasonably successful, especially in recent years, war against the Afghan state and NATO, even at lower levels of NATO. But there doesn't need to be a unified Taliban movement in order to have continued fighting within and throughout Afghanistan, and for the Afghan state to have trouble consolidating itself, especially as U.S. and NATO forces have dwindled to under 10,000. So you can see continued insecurity no matter what happens with the Taliban leadership. But in order for it to be an effective insurgent movement that can make claims on leadership of the country and negotiate and so on, you really do need to have this top leadership.
Daniel Markey, adjunct senior fellow for South Asia with the Council on Foreign Relations, speaking with my colleague Susan Yaki. Still ahead, two country music stars, a mother and daughter, get together again to hit the road. This is VOA.
From science and technology, here's what's new.
What's new? A bicycle that can't be stolen. More than 15 million bikes are stolen every year worldwide, including two bikes from a Chilean inventor, Andres Roy. So he and two friends, Juan Jose Monsalve and Cristobal Cabello, designed an unstealable bike. They call it the Yurka. The Yurka has a frame that turns into a lock. Part of the frame swivels out. Another part of the frame is also reconfigured so that both parts are connected around a bike rack, a guardrail, light pole, whatever. Since the aluminum frame is the lock, cutting the lock would destroy the bike. Andres Roy says despite the innovative security, the Yurka looks just like any other traditional bike.
But we also wanted to make it comfortable, a traditional bike design. We didn't want users to have to carry around a heavy lock either, and our technology can be adapted for any kind of bike.
The bike costs around $500 US, but as of now, they're sold out. For VOA's What's New, I'm Todd Grosson.
This is VOA's International Edition coming to you from Washington. European Union ministers will meet in Paris Saturday to look for ways of tightening regional security after last week's attack on a high-speed train traveling from the Netherlands to France. An inquiry is in progress, meanwhile, to find out more about Moroccan-born Ayoub El Kazani, the man accused of launching last Friday's failed attack. Lisa Bryant reports.
At a news conference here, Paris prosecutor François Molins offered details about Kazani's past and the minutes leading up to the attack. Molins dismissed the suspect's claim that he was not a jihadist, but rather a homeless man planning to rob a train.
Il y a donc lieu aujourd'hui de considérer.
Molins said Kazani is accused of acting with terrorist purposes and attempts to assassinate people. He said the Moroccan had used a mobile phone to watch a jihadi video calling for violence minutes before the attack. His actions appeared targeted and premeditated. Kazani faces several charges, including attempted murder of a terrorist nature. Facebook says it shut down Kazani's account on Saturday because of terrorist content.
Je vous dis la vérité, mon frère n'a aucune relation avec le terrorisme.
On Radio Monte Carlo, Kazani's older brother, Imran, denied the charges, saying his brother was no terrorist. He said after the train attack, authorities in Morocco, where he lives, had questioned him and seized his phone. Kazani's father has also been quoted as saying he finds the charges against his son unbelievable. Investigators are looking into how Kazani obtained his weapons and whether he had accomplices. They're also looking at details about his travels, including whether he spent time in Syria. Molin says Kazani lived in the Paris suburb of Aubervilliers for several months. Lisa Bryant for VOA News, Paris.
Naomi and Winona Judd were once one of the top country music acts in the United States, winning 5 Grammy Awards, plus numerous Academy of Country Music and Country Music Association Awards. Now the duo is reuniting. International Edition's David Byrd spoke with VOA Country Hits USA host Nikki Strong about their new tour.
If you're a fan of country music, the names Naomi and Winona Judd are very recognizable to you. But we haven't heard from the pair known as the Judds since the early 1990s. Nikki, that was when Naomi was diagnosed with hepatitis C.
Yes.
And she thought she'd never perform again.
Yep.
But we have good news.
Yes! She overcame, and of course, another residency is now in the works, another tour. They're going to be in Las Vegas October 7th through the 24th. It's a residency. It's called Girls Night Out, a nod to their 1985 number one.
It's a girl's night out, honey, there ain't no doubt. I'm going to dance every dance till the boys go home.
This is going to be the first joint performance for the mother duo in 5 years. They did the last encore tour back in 2010, 2011. The concert is going to feature some of their biggest hits. They're doing the set list. They're going to be doing Mama, He's Crazy, Why Not Me, Love Can Build a Bridge, which you know is the song of the title track of their last studio album. And it also marks their 25th anniversary of that album.
Wow.
Yeah.
And so this is going to be at the Venetian in Las Vegas?
Yes, at the Venetian. And also Wynonna's going to be performing tracks from her solo career as well.
Yeah, now Wynonna, we should mention, did go on to have a rather successful solo career after her mom had to leave the road.
Yes.
Because, you know, hepatitis C is a very serious disease,
yes,
and the rigors of touring, Naomi had no choice. I remember it was quite heart-wrenching for her.
Yeah, yeah. And also because you can die from hepatitis C.
Right.
So, and Wynonna is saying this tour, this residency rather, is she said she looked at it as an incredible opportunity to celebrate her mom.
Hmm.
And she even said, when this opportunity was presented to me, she was like, I had to take it. I have a new album coming out soon, and this is the perfect way to honor the roots that gave me the wings to fly.
Wow. Now, this residency thing,
mm-hmm, mm-hmm,
this is not the first time that a country act has done this. We had Brooks and Dunn have,
yes,
also done this.
Yes.
Reba McEntire,
yes,
has also done this.
Shania Twain.
Shania Twain has also done this.
Yes.
And so it's a way for people to go and see some of their country favorites without the country favorites having to go all over the country.
Also, Wynonna is working on a new album.
Oh.
Yes, so this is a great segue. It's a project with her husband. She's calling it, you know, it's vintage yet modern, but I think it's coming out next year.
All right, well, we look forward to that, and we look forward to hearing from you. You can send us a tweet at VOA underscore music. You can also send one to at VOA underscore IE for International Edition. And you can listen for Nikki's show, which is Country Hits USA, on our website, www.voanews.com.
Mama, he-
That's it for this edition of International Edition. You can get more news, information, and features on our website at voanews.com. Thank you for joining us. I'm Ray Kugel in Washington. Enjoy the day.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
The government of Guinea and two main opposition parties there have signed an agreement to settle their dispute over terms of the upcoming presidential election, raising hopes of an inclusive and peaceful vote. The deal, reached after weeks of informal talks, allows for representation in local communal councils to reflect results of the 2013 legislative election. As part of the agreement, the government pledged to give the opposition representation in 128 of Guinea's 343 districts. The agreement also addresses the opposition's concern about the integrity of voter registration lists. The government agreed to establish a technical committee attached to the National Independent Electoral Commission to review the lists. Finally, there was agreement to replace two recently deceased members of the commission with opposition members. Guinea has made solid progress since its democratic transition in November 2010, but the terms of the October 11th presidential elections have been in dispute. The opposition has staged protests, some resulting in injuries and several deaths. The United States commends the agreement reached between Guinea's ruling and opposition political parties, which clears the way for Guinea to hold the first round of presidential elections next month. The government and opposition political parties demonstrated goodwill, flexibility, and a shared commitment to holding credible, inclusive, and peaceful elections. We remain committed to supporting the electoral process and urge the parties to continue dialogue throughout the election period, committing themselves and their supporters to nonviolence. We encourage all parties to build on this positive development by working together to prepare for the elections according to the new agreement. The United States sees a role for all Ghanaians in standing together at this important moment and ensuring the upcoming elections unify the nation and strengthen its democracy.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government. For a transcript of this and other VOA editorials, or to receive editorials by email, visit the VOA Editorials Internet homepage at www.voanews.com/editorials.